Hey, welcome to the podcast of Midtown Fellowship 12 South. This is Elliot Cherry, the pastor. And I've said often on Sundays that we don't believe that you've come to church that day, but that if you belong to Jesus, you are the church. See, we believe that it's not our building, but it's our people that most mark this congregation. And yet, our people have brought so much life, joy, and love that our building is now bursting at its seams. And so we're going to embark on a special season together. For 8 weeks in September and October, we're going to celebrate a new vision for our building, our church, and the city of Nashville. And so I'm asking everyone who calls 12 South home, even if you listen from afar, would you join us in this season? If you are in Nashville, would you please come join with us every Sunday during this season to be a part of the legacy that we're living today and shaping for generations to come? If you're interested in learning more, please visit livingalegacycampaign.org to learn more about this vision and how you can be a part of it. Thanks for listening and enjoy the sermon. This series is meant to be our capital campaign vision series. And I don't even like the words capital campaign. We all have like a Pavlovian reaction when those words get said in the same sentence. And so we're trying really hard not to make this a capital campaign series where it's just talks about money and talk. We're not doing that. That's not what we're doing. What we believe about our campaign though, and why we're even doing one in the first place is we believe, hey Lord, we're following you in the hopes that we would stay on this corner long term to join in with what has been going on this corner for 120-ish years of the gospel of the beauty of Jesus being revealed to listeners and to communities and to the city. And we want to stay in that storyline. We want that to continue here. And so we're trying to secure our place here for this generation and many generations to come. We want that to be our story here. And so because we want that to be our story here, that we're joining in with a legacy beyond us, we don't want to make our series like, hey, let's do like 5 points of how to give money to a campaign. No, it's let's join with what's already been going on here, which is the beauty of the revelation of Jesus. So that's what we're going to do each week. We're going to sprinkle in our campaign into this series, but really we're going to be talking about what we talk about every week, which is the beauty of the mystery of Jesus. So that's what we're doing. And last week we began our campaign series, which these beautiful storybooks, you should take one if you don't have one. They're in the back, they're up front. Take one. But what we talked about is what is the need that we feel here to even try to secure our place on this corner long term? What's the overwhelmingness we feel across our 4 services, 2 in the morning here, 1 at Waverly Belmont Elementary at 10 a.m., and then the evening service? What's the need of overwhelmness that we feel, and how does Jesus interact with our need of overwhelmness? We looked at feeding of the 5,000, these disciples who were overwhelmed with their exhaustion. And then Jesus said, you give them all something to eat. And so we looked at that. What does Jesus do with our need and our exhaustion? This week, we're going to talk about that word in our campaign and where does it come from? Kind of the main word, the subject, the main noun of our campaign, legacy, living a legacy. Where does that word legacy come from and what does it mean? And what is it about that word of why do we all seem to have this innate longing to join our stories to something that would outlive us, to have something that would go beyond us and make our lives matter and count for something? Why do we want that? Why do we long for that? And to guide us, we're going to be in perhaps the most controversial book in the entire Bible. That's not hyperbolic. I really believe that. And it's not controversial because it's like vulgar. It's controversial because there's no other book like it, and it really leaves the reader quite depressed at the end of it. It's kind of a gut punch from start to finish, this book. It's one of the wisdom books of the Old Testament that most people don't spend a ton of time in. The wisdom books, there's several of them, but Proverbs is a very well-known wisdom book. And then we get to this book right after Proverbs, known as Ecclesiastes. And it's not people's favorite wisdom book. And it is quite intense. It may be my favorite book in the Bible, though, and I'm serious. It's incredibly depressing, and I need some depression in my life. But no, it is such a, like, who wrote this book, and why is it so intense and seemingly, like, without hope? And we're going to talk about that for a little bit. But it is full of wisdom. It is from a perspective, and it is full of wisdom. We'll talk about that. But Proverbs comes at us right before Ecclesiastes. It's just a little bit of a setup before we read a few verses in Ecclesiastes to guide us in this talk about a legacy. Proverbs comes to us, and Proverbs is this
neat, clean worldview. And it essentially says this, Proverbs does, it's Proverbs is just a book of sayings, a book of proverbs and ancient sayings from wise people throughout Israel, mostly Solomon. And it's like, hey, if you live right, if you live wisely, if you trust the Lord, if you don't lean on your own understanding, if you practice ethics and practice honesty, like, your life will go good. It is a wise thing to be a wise person. That's what Proverbs would say to you. And Proverbs is not lying. It is wise to be wise. Do these right things, practice these right things, and your life will typically go well. That's what Proverbs say to you. It'll be health to your bones. Your barns will be full of crops. You'll live long days. You'll have a big family. It sounds great. Thank you, Proverbs. Who doesn't want that? Do the right thing and things will work out for you. It's wise to be wise. That's how Proverbs ends. But then sometimes you do the right thing. Sometimes you think you're trusting the Lord. Sometimes you are trying to practice honesty. Sometimes you're trying to save and plan and do what would be a best practice, and things go terribly. Sometimes the wisdom of Proverbs doesn't always work. So Proverbs is a like a clean book, but Proverbs doesn't seem to account for the glitch in the system of life. Intro Ecclesiastes. So Ecclesiastes is this book that comes along right after Proverbs, necessarily. Like, read Proverbs and then read Ecclesiastes and hold them both together, because Ecclesiastes would come to Proverbs and say, not so fast, my friend, like Lee Corso on College Game Day. Like, hey, whoa, not so, that's a, four of you watch College Game Day. It's a really big program every Saturday morning. Well, college football. Like, what Ecclesiastes wants to say to Proverbs is, hey, do you see all these other examples from your book of Proverbs that you would give, and do you see all these other examples from life that don't always work out the way that you say they work out? Heard a story this week about a realtor in Portland, Oregon, not Tennessee, that she felt like, hey, the practice at my real estate agent office, they kind of cook the numbers a little bit. Like, they kind of fudge on the square footage, and they say, oh, well, that's a bedroom when really it's an office. And so they're kind of fudging the numbers for their own gain. And she felt convicted about, like, guys, I can't do this on my listings. I'm not going to do this. Honesty is the best policy, right? Like, honesty is a good practice. And Proverbs would say you should be honest in your work. So she did that, and then she got fired. And so I was like, hey, Proverbs doesn't tell you what to do when you practice honesty. And in Proverbs' worldview, like, things are going to go well for you if you have honest business practices. And Ecclesiastes would say, not always. This girl doesn't have a barn house full of storage now. She lost her barn. She lost her income. So what do you do with that? That's what Ecclesiastes wants to talk to you about. What do you do when life is not as clean as Proverbs made it sound? What do you do when you practice good things and life doesn't go well? And not just what do? What does it mean? How does it impact, like, the big questions of life when Proverbs is not enough for you? Ecclesiastes wants you to ask those questions. Ecclesiastes wants you to ask life's biggest questions. Ecclesiastes is perhaps the most raw and honest book in the entire canon, and the writer wants to talk to you about all of your endeavors and all of the glitches in the system and all of your longing for a legacy and all of your longing for having a life that, ooh, just turned my mic. There you go. Now you're listening. Ecclesiastes wants to talk to you about having a life that matters and a life that will outlive you and how things don't always work out the way that you thought they would. Ready? You can leave now if you want. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, and then we're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 12 through 17. So Ecclesiastes 1, 1 through 4, this is like intro and overview and a lot of his like summary statements of the entire book and all of his observations. So this is from the NIV. I like this translation a little bit better for our purposes tonight. This is the NIV. We normally preach from the ESV, but this is NIV tonight in case anyone's tracking. This is the words of the teacher, a son of David, the king in Jerusalem. That's his self-introduction. Verse 2, his summary statement of all of life. Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Verse 3, what do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Verse 4, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. And then if you flip the page, Ecclesiastes chapter 2, starting in verse 12. This is him pursuing meaning. Where does it come from? I'm trying to figure out what's going to make a good life. So he's pursued a bunch of different things. Now he turns to a different attempt to make sense of life. Then I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom and also Madison Folly. He's self-reflecting. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? Verse 13, I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise have eyes in their heads, while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I said to myself, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. Verse 16, for the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. Verse 17, so I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Maybe. So the teacher, the preacher, he's called in some translations, that's how he self-introduces, the teacher in Jerusalem, a king in Jerusalem, who wants to write down his observations. That Hebrew word teacher, preacher is Kohelet. Kohelet is just a Hebrew word that means teacher, but it's more than like a lecturer. It's more like a philosopher, a philosophy professor who just wants you to ask questions. And will you deal with the questions of life? So this teacher, this philosophy professor, is trying to get you to think. And here's what he wants you to do, because it's what he did. I want you to take your assumptions about what makes the good life. I want you to take your beliefs about what will make you content in this world. And I want you to play them out. Roll them out and actually deal with them. Don't live behind the mask of them. Deal with them and roll them out to their logical conclusion. He wants you to ask why. Why do you believe what you believe? And if you believe those things, do you see where they lead you in life? Because what he knows is that very few of us have the spiritual or intellectual guts to really ask the real question, why do we do everything we do? Why do we believe the things we believe? Why do we have the relationships we have? Why do we have the jobs we have, the marriages we have, the romances we have? Why do we go to school where we went to school? Why do you pursue what you pursue? Why do you network where you network? Why are you trying to make the money you're making? Do you know why you do anything? And he wants you to ask that because he asked that himself. And so Ecclesiastes is this great experiment book where he's tracking with, let me tell you what happened to me when I did this, and I'm encouraging you to do the same for your own life. He took all of his assumptions and his beliefs about what would make the good life, and he looked reflectively at, why am I doing all this? And he put them all to the test. That's what the whole book is. And after all of his experiments, after all of his pursuits, after all of his chasing after what would make his life seem to matter, here's what he discovered. It's the summary statement of the whole book. It's verse 2. Everything else is an outworking of this observation. After all of his pursuits, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. He'd be real fun at parties. Hey, Kohelet, you want to go to tap room and talk about the game? No, he doesn't. He doesn't care about the game. He doesn't care about tap room. Doesn't care about good beer. Doesn't care about you. Doesn't care about relationships. Doesn't care about friendships. Everything's meaningless. Why would we go to tap room and waste our time? Why would we go and talk about Roll Tide? Like, why would we go and talk about why? Why does it matter? The conclusion of Ecclesiastes, the conclusion of Kohelet is life is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That Hebrew word for meaningless is hevel. Everything is hevel, 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 hevel. Everything is hevel. It's Kohelet's favorite word. It's used 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes over and over and over again. And in Hebrew, it's a great metaphorical word because it's literally the word for smoke. And it's a metaphor because here's what he's saying. It's like vapor. Life, he's saying, is smoke. Life is vapor. Here's why it's a great metaphor. Because smoke, like if you've been around a bonfire, you've been around people smoking cigars, like smoke is real. You can see it. You can point to it. Everyone around you will go, yeah, I see smoke coming off of this thing. I can see it, I can point to it. No one is gonna think I'm dreaming when I talk about the smoke that we all see. But smoke has this really unique quality that if you go to grab the smoke, if you go to like take it and like, oh, that's a real substance. You grab it, you try to grab it, it disappears. That's what he's saying the meaning of life is like. That's what he's saying all the answers to the question of what is the meaning of life, that's what those are like. They all just vape away. It's like an aerosol can. They just, psst, and then it's gone. And smoke is this really frustrating thing because it's like getting on a plane and seeing all the clouds outside and you go, that looks like the softest bed ever. I wonder if I jump on that, if it would catch me. It won't. But it looks like it would. That's what smoke is. And that's what he's saying life is like. The answers that are out there for all of life's biggest questions are like smoke. They're like a cloud. They look real. They're there, but they have no substance. In the end, they won't catch you. In the end, they can't actually offer you anything that lasts or that matters. And remember, this book is right after Proverbs. Proverbs doesn't sound like everything is hevel. Proverbs doesn't sound like everything is meaningless. Proverbs sounds like life can go great for you. Life can go well for you. You store up, you save, you practice ethically, you have a great family, everything can go well for you. But Qohelet is saying, yeah, but Proverbs, I actually discovered there's a glitch in the system of life. Things I thought were certain, things I thought were true, things I thought I could build my life on to have a full life, to have a content life, to have a life that mattered. I tried all those things, and they're not always true. And so some scholars translate hevel as absurd. Because if you live a life thinking like, oh, I can bank on this, I can trust this, this is solid, I can grab this and it's got substance to answer life's biggest questions, it'll actually drive you mad. It's absurdity. It'll drive you crazy. And so the biggest glitch that he wants to talk to you about, the biggest absurdity that he wants to talk to you about, he says everything's meaningless, everything's hevel, everything's smoke, nothing is actually of substance. And the thing that drives Qohelet to discover that more than anything, the thing that makes him feel more absurd than anything, is his first question in the book. It's not rhetorical, but he's trying to get you to ask it with him. And it's what brings us here tonight. It's what deals with our longing for a legacy. It's what deals with all of our desires to have a life that matters and a life that's contented, life to the full, to make a difference. And if you ask this question honestly with Qohelet, it'll lead you into like the abyss. It'll torment you. It'll shake and rattle like the very foundations that you thought you were standing on of like, this is why I exist. This is why I live. This is why I do the things I do. But if you'll actually ask this question and answer it honestly, you'll go with Qohelet and everything might be shaken for you. It's verse 3, chapter 1. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Okay, gain is the same word there for profit. What's a profit? Profit is like after you've like worked and labored and paid all your bills and paid all your debts, what you have left over. It's the thing that has substance after you've done all the spending and after you've done all the paying and after you've done all the exerting. So the word gain there, the word profit there, here's what he's asking about life. What is of permanent value after you've spent your life? After you've paid off the debts of life, what is remaining that actually matters and has any value? After your effort, after your business you've started, after you've paid your debts, after you've lived your life and it's all over, what do you have to show for it at the end of life? And Qohelet is asking you to have the courage to ask that question. When all is said and done, after all the busyness, after all the laboring, after all the working, after all the scurrying, after all the planning, after all the networking, after all the traveling, after all the familying, after all the, I went to this school and I did this thing and then my career advanced this way, after all the child rearing, after all those things, after all of the next things in your life, that's what we're all looking through, right, is the next thing to deliver. After all those things, when you run out of next things, what did your life matter for? What is your life actually accomplishing? What difference are you making in the world after all those things? What is your life about? How do you know that your life mattered? Did your life make a dent in anything? Like, really? Did it accomplish anything that is lasting? Did it have any gain at the end, any profit at the end? And I know there's 1,000 versions to try to answer, a thousand ways to try to answer that question, like what makes your life matter? But before you try to answer that with some sort of like pat, self-justifying, normal answer, because here's how we try to answer that question, like, oh, my life matters because like I lived it to the full. And like I made the world a better place. I left it better than I found it. I helped people who were in need. And I left it better for my kids. I treated people with kindness, and I did all the things that were set before me, and I traveled where I wanted to travel, and I made what I wanted to make, and I owned a home, and I did all the things. Those are all like the really shallow ways we try to let go, but I did a good job, and so I won't have any regrets on my deathbed. That's what we're all trying to do, is not have any regrets on our deathbed. That's what we all want. And so those are all like the shallow, I did okay, I tried my best, I had good intentions, I was kind to people. That's what we try to answer the what we have to gain at the end of life question with. Before we do that though, he's already one step ahead of you and he's already trying to shut that up. Because here's what he says in verse 4. And it doesn't sound like this, but go with his logic here. It doesn't sound so harsh at first, but listen to what he's actually saying to you. Verse 4, generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Here's what he's saying. Hey, you're a generation. We're all in this generation. And then we're going to go, and then we're going to die. And guess what comes after us? Another generation. Guess what comes after them? Another generation. And guess what comes after them? Another generation. And guess what stays the same? This meaningless world. And so all the generations that think like, we're going to make a difference. Like we're going to do it. We're going to make a change, and we're going to rule the world, and we're going to have it at our fingertips, and we're going to live life to the full, and we're all going to do it. That generation's going to die, and then another one's going to come, and then they're going to think they can do it, and then they're going to die, and then another one's going to come. There's a replacing of the generations, and that never stops. They just keep on going. Right after verse 4 and verse 7, we didn't read it, he'll say, rivers flow into the ocean and the ocean never fills. Meaning like all the attempts from all the rivers of our life, and then there's this ocean that never quite seems to be full, never quite seems to make a difference. He continues to play this out. So chapter 1, he goes on, and then chapter 2, he's going to tell you all the things he pursued to try to make his life matter. Women and wine and power and money and influence and impact. And none of those things seem to do it. He says, I denied my eyes nothing which they saw. Like I went and got everything and I had access to do it. He was like way, way bigger deal than Jeff Bezos in his time. Like he was like, I could do it all and I did it all and none of it seemed to matter. And so then I pursued something different. Chapter 2, look at verse chapter two, verse 15. He's like, I'll pursue wisdom. Maybe if I'm a wise person, that'll make a difference. And people will think, what a wise man, what a difference he made. But look at what he says about becoming a wise person. Then I said to myself, after pursuing wisdom, this is verse 15 of chapter 2. Then I said to myself, but the fate of the fool will overtake me also. So what then do I gain, profit, from being wise? I said to myself, this too is meaningless. Verse 16, for the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise too must die. So here's what he's saying. I pursued wisdom with my toil and my time, and I thought I'll become wise and that'll make a difference and people will remember me for that and I'll impact the world and I'll find contentment and I'll live life to the full. But then I realized, wait, my fate, my end, is no different than someone who didn't pursue wisdom but pursued folly and foolishness. Because guess what happens to both of them? They both die. And guess what happens to both of them after they die? No one remembers them. That's what he says right here in verse 16. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Do you know how he knows that no one's going to remember or be able to tell the difference between who was wise and who was foolish in their day, is that he's living life presently and going, there were people before me, the days have already come when the wise and the fool have already been forgotten. He's like, I don't know who was wise two generations before me. Doesn't matter to me. I don't know who was foolish and who was wise. I can't even tell you their names. They've already been forgotten. They both die and no one is going to remember you, he says. They will not be long remembered. Do you know in two generations from right now, after two generations after you die, no one will even know your name? And another generation will be here and no one will be talking about you or the impact that you had or what you did with your life, you'll be dead and no one will care. Aren't you glad you came to church tonight? If you came with a friend, like if someone brought you tonight, they should not have brought you tonight. You should have gone somewhere else. One scholar said this week about that observation that he has about like the wise and the fool. They both die and no one remembers them. The time has already come when fools and wise have already been forgotten. This is what one scholar said about his Qohelet's observation. He says, what oppresses Qohelet is not so much the inevitability of death, like death comes for all. That's not what oppresses him. What oppresses him here is, I love this phrase, the fact that death deletes distinctions of quality that we think should be respected. Death deletes distinctions of quality that we think should be respected. Like, hey, death can't equalize us. I've spent my life trying to be better than you and judge you because you're not as good as me. And so if I've spent all my time trying to be wise or trying to be like observant or trying to be kind or whatever I've put my, I'm trying to be rich, trying to like matter in the world, and then death comes and just levels all that, death doesn't care. Death deletes distinctions of quality that we think should be respected. I thought my life could matter. I thought if my intentions were good, if I tried hard, if I like lived life to the full, if I only like did what was best for everyone, it would make a difference. But death comes along and equalizes us and makes us deal with the fact that, do you know, your little breath of a life is and one day will be utterly meaningless. This is all his like outworking of his initial question for the whole book in chapter 1, verse 3, what we read. What do we gain from spending our lives? Does it matter? Does it mean anything? And we all try to answer that question by like making with like pseudo comfort of like, well, yeah, like I was a good person and I like tried to treat people well and I did good things and I got good grades and I saved my money and I invested it properly and I like did all the good things. Let's leave it better than we found it. Let's make it better for the youth of tomorrow. Let's enjoy our lives and make the best of it. That's what we think will save us from regret on our deathbed. And Qohelet would come to you and say, give me a friggin' break. It's not going to matter. He would say to you, do you know like your life is like a footprint on the wet sand by the tide? And like you put a print in the sand and you go, look, I made a mark. I did something. I mattered here. And then less than 2 seconds later when the tide comes in, it's gone. It's like it never happened. It's like it doesn't exist. That's what Qohelet would say your life is like. Or even like, I've done this plenty of times with my kids, or I grew up near the beach, so I would do this all the time. Like you build these like big sandcastles with like moat systems and like, oh, if the water comes here and it'll drain out that way. I've done that for hours and then literally in an hour, it's gone. No one knows how much time you spent working on that. No one knows how much you labored for that. It doesn't matter, it's gone. It's as if it didn't exist. Okay, if the isn't just another analogy in case you're not depressed enough. Here's another one. If we could take all the stories of every life that has ever existed in the history of the world, and we could put them on like a timeline in this room and like wrap it around like little dots of people's lives that have all existed, all the kingdoms, all the kings and queens, and all the artists, and all the innovators, and all the economies, and all the advancements, and all the things that have happened in the history of the world, and we can make a timeline that would wrap itself around the room over and over and over again. Do you know no one would even know if your dot of a life was on that timeline or not? Someone literally asked after the 9 a.m. service, asked and texted me this, asked ChatGPT how many lives have existed in the history of the world? Around 118 billion, they think. And then they asked, out of those 118 billion, how many names do we know from history? Like a little less than a million, which is 0.001% of all the names that have ever existed you've heard of. No one's gonna notice if your dot is on the timeline or not. They're not. The names you remember, that like, great, that's less than 0.001% of all the names that have ever existed. No one will remember you or what you've done. And you want to leave a legacy? You want to make a dent in the world with your little dot of a life? Kohelet would say, are you kidding me? It's not going to matter. Percy Shelley wrote a poem, Ozymandias, which I learned after the 11 o'clock. People felt really free to correct a lot of stuff this morning. I thought it was a fictional king. It's a real king. Ozymandias was a real king that Percy Shelley wrote a poem about. And some people think Ozymandias was about a pharaoh. No one knows that for sure. But Ozymandias is this poem about this, written by Percy Shelley, about this king. And this king was great in power, great in might. And Percy Shelley literally stumbles upon this statue of Ozymandias buried under the sand in the desert. And the irony of, oh, Ozymandias was this great king, and Ozymandias was this powerful ruler, and he had this empire, and now what's left of him is a decrepit, limbless statue buried in the desert sand, and no one's ever heard of him. And written on the plaque of the statue that is stumbled upon in the desert are these words about Ozymandias and his great empire that he wrote about himself, this victor. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Like, look at how powerful I am, all you mighty other rulers, and be afraid of me because I am so mighty, says the decrepit statue in the desert now. Like, there was a time when Ozymandias thought he was a big deal. There was a time when he thought he mattered. Not anymore. That's what Kohelet is trying to get you to see about your own life. And as I sat in this week, I read a bunch on Ecclesiastes in 1 and 2, listened to a bunch on it, talked to Joseph, our worship leader, about it as we planned the service. By the way, really fun to plan a service that you know no one's going to remember. Like, really, really fun to, like, plan this thing for hours at a week that you go, doesn't matter, it's meaningless. Like, it's not going to make a dent. And as I sat in this week, here's this honesty from Kohelet of, like, will you just be honest with yourself about the world you live in and what your life actually is? Listen to where he lands, because it's actually him being remarkably honest with you. Look at the end of our section from chapter 2:17. Listen to what he says. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. If you will let his questions guide you, it will lead you to a place of bottomless despair. He hated life. That's an author of a book of the Bible telling you he hated life. And some of you have felt that bottomless despair before. I know you. I know some of your stories. Some of you have dealt with that existential dread of utter despair at the bottom of the well. Some of you have dealt with depression as you have looked at or had to been forced to deal with, like, the tidal wave of life coming over you and realizing, like, I can't deal with the meaning of all this or the pain of all this or the loss of all this. And you know what bottomless despair is like. You've been in that well before. And if you have been, Kohelet would look at you and say, good. You should feel that way, because that's what it means to actually deal honestly and rawly with life. At least you have some intellectual honesty in admitting that this is the natural outworking of your assumptions and beliefs about life. Good that you feel that despair. So have you felt it before? Do you feel it now? Or in the way that I heard it put this week, I love this phrase. Have you come to realize in life that rock bottom has a basement? Like, you thought you knew what the bottom was, but it can get worse. It can get darker. It can get more meaningless than you're currently feeling. It can go darker. Have you been to the bottom of that well before? If you have, but only if you have, if you have felt that before, there's actually a rope in this book. There's a rope to get you out. There's a rope the reader can grab and actually climb out of that despair. And Qehelet leaves the rope for you. I don't know if he meant to leave it or not, because the book doesn't end with him telling you a whole lot about how he continues on in life after all of his despair. But he leaves a rope for you. And the rope is in our two passages that we read. It's all throughout the book. It's his second favorite phrase in the book after Hevel, after meaningless, after smoke. It's his second favorite phrase, and it's the only way out of bottomless despair. He says it in verse 3 of chapter 1 and verse 17 of chapter 2. It's this little phrase, under the sun. It's a rope for you, because here's what he's doing. Qehelet is confessing to you his perspective. He's remarkably honest about his perspective, but here's what he also is telling you about his perspective. His perspective, self-admittedly, is limited. He's telling you about life under the sun, life in this world, life in this frame, life inside and in the constraints of space and time, life in this buffered world, life down here. And he's right. Don't dismiss his conclusions. Don't downplay where he leads us. If life under the sun is all there is, if there's no bigger storyline than you in this buffered frame, if there's no cosmic tale being told in the cosmos, if all we have is this frame, there is no way you and your little dot of a life can make a dent. There is no way. Your life is a vapor and your life is meaningless. That is real, if all there is life under the sun. So when you hear that, why do you think there's something inside of you that doesn't want to swallow it? Why does it, like, why do we buck against that in our souls? Like, it can't all be meaningless. There's got to be more. There's got to be something more than this. There's no way. Is it possible that you were made to be connected to something that would outlive you? Is it possible that something's hardwired into your DNA, and what's hardwired in is an ache for something bigger than this frame? Like, do you know that deep within you, like buried within you, Ecclesiastes will actually go on to say this, you have a longing hardwired into you for transcendence. Meaning, you have something that is longing for a story to be bigger and above the sun. And so in order for your life not to be utterly meaningless in this frame, not to be lost in the bottomless despair that Qehelet is talking about, here's what has to happen to you. Your finite life has to be connected with something above the sun. It can't stay under the sun, because under the sun, this is all that there is. Meaning you have to be connected to something transcendent. You have to be connected to something infinite. But if all you have is what's under the sun, it will only lead to despair. And if you go there, if you're willing to go there to the place where Qehelet would lead you under the sun, if you're honest enough, intellectually and emotionally and spiritually courageous enough to admit that life under the sun, this is what this means for my life under the sun. If you go there, it will crush you. That's why no one wants to go there. That's why people stay in Proverbs and don't want to read Ecclesiastes. Give me Proverbs life. Oh, if I'm honest, if I trust the Lord, life goes good. I have a good family. I have barn houses full of store. Like, okay, that's cool. And then you turn the page and you go, no, I'll just stay in Proverbs. That's why no one wants to read this book. It's too terrifying to go down the path that Ecclesiastes wants to lead you on. But what if the ache of Ecclesiastes and Qehelet, what if the longing that you have to not be forgotten, what if the sadness and the barrenness that you feel is actually meant to awaken you to something? What if that's the pathway? What if it's meant to open you up to consider with all these big, huge existential questions about life and purpose and what's the meaning of all this and why are we here and what's the storyline being written and all those? What if all of under the sun life was meant to wake you up and have to deal with the fact that maybe there's a storyline bigger than the sun? What if the ache was the only place that you and I would ever lift our eyes off of ourselves, our little dots of a life, and the ache would be the only thing that would liberate us from trying to get all of our meaning and purpose and contentment from our little life? What if bottomless despair is actually waking you up to the longing you have for a home that you were made for? Because here's what you'll find if you lift your eyes above the sun, into transcendence, outside of space and time. Here's what you'll find is that there's actually a story in the other 65 books of the Bible, not Ecclesiastes, where you will find a God, the God who made the sun. The God who made the sun, the transcendent one, is the same God who actually came beneath the sun himself. He's the God who came under it. He's the God who came into space and time. The story of the Bible is the story of the transcendent one who became the immanent one. The story of the Bible is the story of a God who wrote himself into the story. Why would he do that? Why would the transcendent one write himself into the pages, into the story of life under the sun? To redeem your meaningless life. And to bind it up with his own life. That's what Jesus came to do. The transcendent one who put skin on, the infinite one who like became a baby, who could be wounded by us, his creation. He actually came and went to the bottomless pit of despair. He went into the rock bottom basement and was crushed by the house. The house collapsed on him. In order to redeem your life from the reality of meaninglessness. And so when your life is bound up to his, when your life is connected to something that is transcendent, here's what is now true about your life and the meaning of your life. You are now connected to something that will outlive your life permanently. Your life is now connected to something that's way above the sun, so it's not meaningless anymore. Like this is how functional and practical this reality is for the believer and for the members of the kingdom of God in all of its transcendence. Here's what this means for you now. Your life is not meaningless anymore. It's connected to his meaning. So you don't have to go out and try to prove or extract meaning from your life, from your little dot of a life. Your life already has meaning because it's connected to his. Now you don't have to go out and make a name for yourself and make people respect you and make people tell you that your life is mattering and that it's going to keep mattering. You don't have to make a name for yourself. You already have a name. From the transcendent one, you have a name. So you don't have to make a name. Your life doesn't have to go out and make people pay attention to it. Your life doesn't have to go out and demand that this life give you significance. You don't have to be Ozymandias and make a statue for yourself with a plaque on it. That tells everyone, look at who I am and look at what I've done. Everyone should be afraid of how accomplished I am. Your life and your legacy is now bound up above the sun. So you don't have to force everyone beneath the sun to remember you. Everything's going to be forgotten. You don't have to make that different in this little dot of a life. You don't have to create a legacy for yourself because Jesus has now made you a part of his legacy. Kohelet's right, though. A generation will come and a generation will go and no one will remember your name. You will be long forgotten. That is true. You just won't be forgotten by Jesus, which is all that matters. And in this world that Kohelet wants you to look at with honesty, look at with courage, and admit all the things that he concludes are true, here's what he wants you to admit. And you need to admit this. In this life, you will lose everything you love. Everything you've built, every relationship you have will end in death. Every reputation you've made for yourself, every accomplishment, every achievement, you will lose all of it. You will lose all of your assets. You will lose all of your accomplishments, all of your trophies, all of it. All the accolades, you will lose everything. Your dog? Like you will lose everything you love. It's just now you have a hope in Jesus, the transcendent one, that means this: even if you lose everything, he will never lose you. And that's actually way more comforting. You will lose everything, but he won't lose you. And so as we talk about this legacy in our campaign and why we're calling it Living a Legacy and all that, and Like, we want to be on this corner for generations that will come and go, where like in 100 years, the gospel's still going forth from this corner and no one's talking about us or this generation. We want to tie our stories up with something that will outlive us. We want to, like, no one knows the names of the pastors or the elders or the staff or the small group leaders or the deacons 100 years ago. But I know this, lives were changed 100 years ago, and we hope the same story is true 100 years from now. That's why we want to be here. But we're not talking about legacy and having a life that matters through Ecclesiastes and transcendence and imminence. We're not talking about all that so that you write a check to the campaign. I don't care if you do. I won't know if you do. Like, we don't know who gives what here. I've tried to log in. I can't get in. Like, I've tried to get into the system. We can't get in. Like, no one's going to know. That's not why we're talking about Ecclesiastes and a breath of a life and vapor. We're not talking about that tonight. But it is a way to join in with something that's bigger than your life and your story and your little dot. This is a way. But don't hear that tonight. Don't leave here thinking about that tonight. Leave here believing that in this life you will lose everything. But there is a Jesus who won't lose you. Leave here knowing that you don't actually have to make everyone out there remember you and what you've done, because you have a Jesus that will never forget you. That's what you leave here believing. And so your legacy is now tied up with him. So it's safe. Your life is not meaningless anymore because it's bound up with his. So let's pray and then we'll sing out about that together. Jesus, it is so easy to feel the cross pressure of longing for transcendence, longing for our home, longing for a reality that's bigger than us, while also feeling the finiteness of a life that's a mist, a life that's a breath, a life that no one will remember. And so Jesus, humble us by this, but don't humiliate us. Give us the freedom, the liberation of not having to make our life be one that is remembered by everybody. Because we actually have the comfort and the gift of knowing you will not forget us. So we're okay. Would you help us to rest in that tonight, to find our meaning in that, in your transcendent story, and be a people who believe it as we leave this place tonight? We pray in your name. Amen.